Hello and welcome to episode 10 of the Fine Watches podcast. For this episode, we travel to Sydney. We're having a conversation with Christo Hoppe, who's the founder of Bozelle. It's a distinctly Aussie brand, boasting high-quality Swiss parts, and one that celebrates the Australian lifestyle and environment in a really interesting and unique way. It was the first Australian brand to be invited to exhibit at Basel, and this year the brand celebrates its 10th anniversary. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I enjoyed talking to Christo. Fine Watches podcast episode 10, here we go. Welcome, Christo, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, Ben. I really appreciate that you thought of me. Thank you.
Absolutely my pleasure. Christo, can you tell us about your personal rather than professional history with watches? Do you collect them? What started the passion for you?
Yeah, well, look, it started quite early. Of course, you know, the parents, the grandparents always, you know, looked at, you know, the watches, always were interested. As a little kid, you're interested in cars and engines, and they're a bit too big and a bit too difficult to deal with. So you go into smaller things, watches, automatic watches. I grew up in Saudi Arabia until the age of 12. And a funny story is that my parents lost me in the souk when I was 11. And they found me again, luckily. And I was negotiating a Casio with the little calculator, and I wanted to buy it. Of course, I didn't get the watch. My parents were pretty mad, but I always been interested in watches. And then I got my hand on automatic. Of course, I was, you know, like a little kid, always opening and breaking everything up, which I did. I did break that watch. Was not able to put it back together, and that started a passion.
That's a super cool story about the souk in Saudi Arabia. I would imagine that your parents would have been a little bit frantic, 11-year-old running around. They're usually pretty chaotic, the markets.
Yeah. No, but you're very safe. You know, back in the day in Saudi Arabia, if you stole anything, you would have the hand cuts. And so there was no stealing. There was no mischief in anything. So it was pretty safe. But still, you know, you lose your kid, you're not happy. And if he wants to negotiate a watch, he's not going to get the watch.
Can you give us an overview of your working history in the watch industry? Because you've worked both in products and then parts as well, from what I can see.
Yeah, look, I'm an ex-boring accountant. So I worked, I started my career at PricewaterhouseCoopers as an auditor and a consultant. But the passion of watches that started at the age of 11 or 12 when I was a kid, it was still there. And I really wanted to work in watches. So I moved from Luxembourg to Geneva. And once you're in Geneva, you're surrounded by ads of watches everywhere. And you're like, come on, I want to work in watches. So what I did, it was very tacky, but I bought some beautiful paper, and I wrote a nice letter targeted to every watch brand there was. And there's one that got back to me, and I became the CFO for a brand called Technomarine, which was really well known at the time, selling a lot of watches with the plastic rubber strap and the diamond bezel. It was a real success, and it was amazing to be part of that brand at the time, beginning of 2000, directly working with the sole owner of the company, Franck Dubarry. So that was the brand side. So, you know, that's I call it the champagne and sparkle and, you know, private jet sort of side of the industry. But that's not the one that I prefer. I was lucky enough to go on the other side, which is a component manufacturer. And I was the CFO, part of the Swatch group of a company called Universo, who manufactures all the hands for the group. And that's where you really know the industry. Because when you have all the press release saying that such brand is selling so much and doing so well, and you're the supplier of that brand, and you're like, come on, I haven't delivered any watch hands for the last 6 months. How come you're doing so well? What are you selling? You know? And, so you really know exactly what's happening in industry when you're in a component and you can see the machines. And, as a CFO, I would always be in the manufacturer, in the factory, understanding how machines were working, how people were working to produce. So I've been lucky enough at the Swatch group that they put me in a program where I spent time in every manufacturer. So I spent time with at Rudin for the case, for the dial, for the hands. I know I'm not a specialist, of course, you know, but I know how to make every component, and that's what the real passion in watches is for me. It's the technical side.
I'm guessing that the System 51 wasn't around at that time because it's only sort of last few years, but they're so innovative and I think very, very underrated as being one of the brands that really reinvigorated the wristwatch market after the quartz crisis. So obviously quartz product, but it really reinvigorated that idea that having something fun on your wrist and that brought you joy on your wrist was something to be thought about.
No, totally. And you're talking about the Swatch brand. I was working for the Swatch group. So there's 18 brands, you know?
Understood.
There's Breguet, there's Blancpain, there's Longines, all those amazing brands. So yes, we were manufacturing the hands even for the Swatch brand in Switzerland. It's amazing, yeah. You know. So it was a different technique. It was more mass produced, but still made in La Chaux-de-Fonds, and up to the Breguet, we're making the hands. But we had a lot of other customers, you know. I can't name them because, you know, but everyone from all the names you think they were customers of ours. So the Swatch group has an immense control on the watch industry, even today.
You mentioned that you were an accountant and worked in the industry as a CFO. I've spoken with a number of founders of independent brands now. Commonly, you've got engineers, you've got industrial designers, you've got marketing people. And I've asked them all variations on the same question, but I suspect that your answer might be a little bit different. But the question is, you know, what was it about watches that made you take the risk to launch your own brand? And as a CFO, I'm sure, you know, your awareness of the financial risks would be very different. So what was it that made you take the leap and start Bozell?
Look, I said I was a boring accountant. I was a very frustrated accountant. So I always had little side projects. When I was at Universo, I had a t-shirt brand I was doing on the side to express my creative side. So I always had that creative side. Coming to Australia, in 2010, I realized taking the train from Chatswood to the city, looking for a job, for work, there was no, it was only Seiko on the wrist of people. And the beautiful watch is absolutely stunning. But I said, come on, there's no Australian watch brand. And yes, there was Adina, but there was nothing more. And I was like, come on, we could do something. And that's how I started. It was just looking around. I couldn't find a job. And it's always the same. You know, you take the leap because you're in a zone of uncomfort and you get out of your shelf and you do something a bit different. If I still had my job, CFO, pay $250,000 a year and having the nice life, of course, I don't think I would have taken the leap. But here I was in a new country following my wife. She's an Aussie. And I was here not knowing anyone, not getting any jobs. Took me 7 months to get a job, even though I had an amazing career in Switzerland, but no one would give me a job because I didn't have that Australian, experience here. So you're a bit like, whoa, come on. I need to find something to do. And, I knew how to make watches thanks to the Swatch group and my little adventure of, you know, going, across all the component manufacturer. And, I knew how to draw because I love drawing since I'm a kid. I'm a bit creative and I was okay. Well, I might do some samples and knock at some doors and see if, I could start a watch brand.
And over the 10 years since the launch, I think it's the 10-year anniversary this year now, right?
It is. Yoo-hoo!
And for a 10-year-old brand, you've had some really quite amazing success points. You were the first Australian brand to be invited to Basel. You have some contracts with the US military. You've done the watch for the Opera House. You've partnered with the RAAF for some commemorative models. What do you think has driven that success for Bozell?
Look, it's like for everything in life, I think it's contacts and who you know, not what you know. So from the, you know, from the early stages, Australians really got behind the concept of having our own Australian brand, and they trusted my expertise coming from Switzerland, and you know, having, you know, knowing the best suppliers. So they liked the quality of what I was doing, the vision for the brand, and they supported me. And you know, one person knows one person knows one person knows one person, and at the end you know, it's not built in a day. The support has been amazing. So it's really the support of people and wanting to help. And I don't think I would have been able to start a watch brand anywhere in the world, especially not in Switzerland, where competition would have been a bit too hard. But here, people were happy to help. And yeah, that's how it happened, really.
That's an interesting answer, because to me, part of the, I have no doubt there's a bit of the who you know and everything, but one of the things that I've found in Australia about either introducing a new brand or creating a brand is that Australians are very cynical. Like, they kind of stick with the ones that they know. They're quite kind of cynical about new things until the quality is proven and everything. So there must be a tangible quality there within the watches, or a design that resonates with the Australian psyche and so on, for it to have been accepted and promoted by some of those, you know, the Opera House, RAAF and all that sort of stuff.
Look, Ben, it didn't start from the start. You know, it took, you know, 5 years to get to those type of conversations. So yes, at the beginning, you know, it was a very slow start, but I was working on the side. I had a regular job as a CFO, and it was just plugging along, growing. And the brand, yes, is 10 years old, but it's been only 5 years that I'm, you know, pretty much full time in the brand and really taking it seriously. The first 5 years was just try and error. And building the brand one watch at the time. And yes, those contacts came. They didn't come, you know, there's no overnight success. So they didn't come at first. And I totally agree with you that it took a little bit of while for the public to get behind. But now they clearly are behind. And we had the best year so far at the end of June in Australia. We end the financial year at the end of June. And so we just closed the accounts. And it's been an amazing year this year, mainly because of what we've done with the Royal Australian Air Force, but also because we focus on what we could do and control, which is the online.
It seems that the market, there are all these established brands owned by Swatch and Richemont and LVMH, and some of the big independents, Patek and Rolex, are still independent brands. But there are also, it seems that the market is there are more and more of these really high quality independents. So Helsen, Farah, who we had last episode, we had Paul, Unimatic, Autodromo. Do you think that there are factors in their success that are parallel for Basel?
Of course, you know, the big five, which we all know at the moment are killing it, but we're not in that market. You know, they're very expensive and beautiful, handcrafted watches. So, you know, all the brands that you name, we're competing around the same price point. It's online. It's a bit easier. And yes, you know, it's a common thread that people are more daring in trying to find their own style and not following the fashion. So yes, some of these brands would be a bit of a homage brand, and they will look a little bit like another watch that already exists that people can't afford and they want to wear it, or they go on to the vintage fashion. That's the fashion of the moment. That's a little bit of an homage of a vintage watch that's from the past. But Basel, we do something completely different. We're a bit more adventurous, and we want people to that, you know, have the confidence to wear something that, yeah, doesn't look like a watch, you know, doesn't look like a vintage watch, just looks like a watch. It's a Bozelle, and it's an Australian watch. And we sell the Australian lifestyle to people. And yeah, it resonates to Australia in Australia because Australians want to support an Australian product. But Australia is so well seen around the world that you know, it's fairly easy. Our second market is France. We're selling a lot of watches in France only online. We don't have any presence in France. We say we ship them all from here, from our store here in 75 George Street in Sydney, and we market, you know, through the usual suspect and advertisements, social ads, and it works. So, and it's only Australia because they don't know the brand. So it's really Australia that's selling to them and music to their ear.
Without private details, but or commercially sensitive details, but what percentage of your sales are inside Australia and outside Australia?
So we're selling now close to 30% outside. So it's still very heavily Australian. We've got a big bespoke part of the business. So that's the Sydney Opera House with the official watch of the Army Intelligence Corps. So the secret agents in Australia wearing our watches, the Special Forces. Funny story with the Special Forces, they spend a lot of time in Afghanistan and they wanted the sand from Afghanistan to be in the watch. So we got the watch with sand of Afghanistan. In the watch, and so that's you know, and in the Opera House we've got a piece of the tile of the Opera House, so it's almost impossible to get a tile of the Opera House, but we've got one, we crushed it and we put it in the watch. And with the Royal Australian Air Force, we've been lucky to be the watch of the centenary of the Royal Australian Air Force. So that's more of a, you know, the bespoke side of the business, where we make watches for others. The Royal Australian Air Force is a collaboration, it's not a real bespoke. And we've got a piece of a plane with the Air Force. So we got a piece of a FA-18, Caribou, and now a Hercules plane. To answer your question, 30% is overseas, mainly France. But we just started the UK, Germany, and the CEO of the company, Aaron Coote, he's based in LA because we are developing the US quite strongly now. So 2022 will be the financial year. 2022 will be the year of the development of the brand in the US.
You touched before about the Bozelle aesthetic, and I think it's quite diverse, really. The RAAF models to me look really quite vintage. They've got that sort of classic pilot watch feel, although a modern twist on it. And then at the other end, you have some really quite modern avant-garde designs as well. Can you talk to us a little bit about where you draw these inspirations from and what inspires that diversity?
It comes from my mad mind, I would say. First, you know, if we look at the Terra Australis, it's completely crazy design, but the idea was not to make it a commercial watch. It was more of, look, we can manufacture in Australia. So we did a joint venture with Flinders Uni down in Adelaide. We've got our small little manufacturing unit, and we were able to create our own material that we put in there. It's just to show the credibility of the brand as a real manufacturer. So that was more the angle. The pilot automatic, so that was done 7-8 years ago. Very different, crazy inspiration of Australia. But absolutely stunning watch. But now if we want to go to the core of the brand is the Ocean Moon. Just by the name, the ocean, the moon, we all live coastal in Australia. That's what people want from the brand. It's a brand that screams Australia, and the Ocean Moon is it. So that's the bread and butter for the brand. We're selling, you know, 80% of our sales is the Ocean Moon. We just launched our fourth generation this year. And we already have, I think, close to 30 reviews online just after 2 weeks that we shipped the watch. So people are loving it. It's great. And it will be a big winner for the year coming for us. But that's really and the Ocean Moon is the same that the Aviator, same case than the Aviator that we did for the RAAF. The Airfield, that's a bit of a different watch. Yes, it looks a bit vintage. Why? Because the last time that the Air Force commissioned a watch was in the 1940s and 50s with IWC and Jaeger LeCoultre. And they wanted something that's because the idea of the centenary is to look in the past and look to the future as well, but don't forget the past. And they wanted something that reflected that past. And the Airfield is that watch. So we looked at what the watch of IWC and Jaeger LeCoultre design cues that they did in the 40s, 50s, and we try not to be too different. That's where it comes from. So we got the credibility of the Air Force designing that watch, you know, as a tribute to the past.
It's a really great spread, and I think it will allow the brand to appeal to a broad, really broad audience of people who do like that heritage aesthetic, and then someone who wants something a bit new and modern. So it's fantastic. Are there any specific, you've mentioned there Jaeger LeCoultre, you've mentioned IWC. Are there any specific pieces or brands from the past that sparked ideas for you, or that are favorites of yours and the wider Boswell team, or do you sort of try and invent something for you totally new?
No, we all inspire ourselves from everything that exists, from details, from everything that exists, you know. For example, the Pilot Automatic, it was my view on the Vacheron Constantin, l'American from 1921, with the crown at 2 o'clock, which is, you know, if we were to talk about a Grail watch at that price point, that would be it. Absolutely love this watch, always loved it, the dial, everything. But if you look at the watch, how it looks completely different. It's just the crown, which is at 2, that I kept from that design. But so that was my inspiration for that watch. But if you look at the Pilot Automatic, you're like, what is he talking about? You know, it doesn't look at the same, but it was my take on that design, for example.
Can you tell us more about the crowns? They contain, for listeners who haven't seen them, they contain elements of Australia. So you mentioned the Bondi sand, the Afghan sand. I would imagine that it'd be quite a complicated manufacturing process. So can you tell me how that works from collecting the sand at Bondi through to how do you put it all together?
Oh, look, it's fairly easy. It's a little container in the crown where you put a glass on top. I just collect the sand at my local beach, and there's still enough sand on the beach. My goal in life would be to empty a beach, but I'm pretty far from that. And it's, you know, we've got some customers that would like their own sand or something that's meaningful to them, and we can do that as well. We even had a story where a very good customer of ours contacted us with the ashes of his dad because he wanted something to keep in the watch that he can then pass on to his kids. I was a bit hesitant at first. I thought it was a bit creepy and weird, but he really insisted. He was a good customer of ours. We did it, and he was so thankful that he could always have that watch on him, and that he will be able to pass it on to his kids. And it was really meaningful. So that's a bit extreme elements, but you know, you grow up in Manly, or you grow up in Saint-Tropez in France, or and you want something that you know, just send us the elements, and we'll do a watch for you.
That's really interesting, because as soon as you said that, my first thought was ashes, actually. You know, I have some ashes of my first dog, and I would imagine that, you know, people, so that's what kind of came to my mind first, but it doesn't surprise me, actually. I would have thought there's a whole market there for you of doing memorial watches for people, I would have thought.
There is, and we do it very now. We're doing it with great pleasure, and we can see the impact now on people. They absolutely love it, and it adds an emotional part to that watch, you know.
Oh, superb, absolutely superb. A very interesting complication that was included on one of the Ocean Moon models, I think it was a limited edition maybe, you included a tide indication. I have had a look, and there seem to have been a few models throughout history, sailing watches and whatnot, that have had that. Can you tell me a little bit more about the inclusion of that complication? Is it something that you think you'll use again? And were there any models that were a specific inspiration for that particular watch?
So no, the inspiration came from the movement manufacturer called ISA Suisse. Rest in peace. They stopped their operation 2 years ago. We bought the last movements from them. We were one of their biggest customer. And unfortunately, they went out of business. They were focusing heavily on quartz. We know the fashion for quartz is not there at the moment. People are more interested in automatic watches. So basically, that's what I love that complication as well, because, you know, I used to live in Sydney, in a place called Balmain, and there's a little pool, Don Fraser pool, where you can only go with the kids when it's low tide. So there's a little beach, they can have fun. So you just have that on your wrist. You can see, it's close to be low tide. Come on, kids, let's go. And I loved it. And you still stay connected to the element. I swim every morning. I'm a mad ocean swimmer. And that's what keep me sane, is that connection to the ocean, the connection to the tide, to the moon. I can tell you exactly what the swell was this morning, where the tide was, and all of that, which is something you don't have in your day-to-day life. You just work 9 to 5 and go into the office. And I wanted people to have that connection on the wrist. So that I'm with you. I love that complication, and I would love to bring it back. The only problem is that the movement now is out. So all the other brands that you saw online using that movement, we're all using exactly the same movement. Is a Swiss 8270 or 8272, I think, movements, and we're all using the same. But now it's not being produced anymore, and it won't be produced anymore. Now the only option would be to develop something yourself that costs way too much money. I wouldn't be able to afford it, or go into an automatic that tells that, but that would be a way too expensive watch for a customer to buy. So unfortunately, I think that I will have to wait a long time, or develop something by myself, which I'm not in the position to at the moment.
It's certainly a very, very interesting complication. As a lover of watches generally, are there any other complications that particularly excite you? There are always common answers of tourbillon, but there's been some very diverse answers from my guests so far. So is there one that you love specifically?
Oh, look, I'm a simple guy. I'm not a tourbillon or that type of thing, which I appreciate. I love it. I find it beautiful. But, you know, a simple GMT to know what time it is for my parents or my friends back in Europe. Love that. And a simple, inner ring or bezel. I love cooking, just so I know the time of cooking when I cook stuff. That's my complication. I love, you know, close to home.
I haven't bought many Kickstarter watches. In fact, I've only ever bought two, and one of them was actually called a grill timer, and it basically looked like a Submariner, but instead of the just time around, it had cooking times of different cuts of meat, so you could turn it around in a minute steak or a T-bone or whatever. It was just so absurd that I had to buy the thing and have a look at it. It's just amazing.
It's awesome, you know. It has a real impact, a real use in your day-to-day life, because who has, you know, people have the GMT, but they don't use it. It just, you know, it's a nice watch and that's it, you know. Who uses the bezel? But that's a perfect example. Someone did in France one with the egg cooking. So, you know, if you want your egg to be hard or not, you know, and it's fun, but it's useful, you know. I never know how long to leave my eggs for, you know, but at least, you know, it has a real meaning for people.
I think that's one of the reasons that the inclusion of the tide indication was so interesting for me on your model, is that GMT is a really good example. World Time is a really good example. I think there are a lot of people who live internationally traveling for work, and I get that maybe they would use it for that, but the practicality of complications is a bit abstract. It's more traditional for a different time, perhaps. I find it very, very interesting when a complication is included that has relevance for today and that you use right now and all the time. As part of this journey of the podcast, I learned about the telephone timing indicators, the 3-minute telephone timing indicator on chronographs. I could never work out why there were these markers at sort of 3 minutes or 2.5 minutes.
No, I didn't know that. I don't know that.
But that sort of long line on the subdials is for telephone timing because it was charged in 3-minute blocks. So people would...
No way.
You could get off. There's a very interesting little brand called Brew Watches out of New York. A guy called Jonathan Farah. He has the timing to pull an espresso, the 30-odd seconds to pull the perfect espresso.
Beautiful.
Very, very interesting when people include something like that. I think that brings us very comfortably to a range of yours, the analog smart watches that you offer. It's a very niche market. There's yourselves, there's Withings, there's only one or two others that make an analog smart. Can you talk to us about that for Bozzle and what inspired you to enter that market?
Look, again, just wanting to be a trailblazer. We're not following anyone at Bozzle. So I just wanted to bring something new, but still a little hint to the past. So the new is the hybrid smartwatch. It's the movement. We're using a movement supplied by Frédéric Constant. So it's a Frédéric Constant. They're doing the app. Everything is Frédéric Constant, but we put our own design on it. The design to me was to bring a vintage, and we called it vintage 2.0. It's a big fashion of the vintage. But it was the way of bringing vintage, but not being a vintage watch at all. It's not an automatic. It's a hybrid smartwatch, and people love it. It drew younger people, younger consumers to the brand. And for us, it's just a great product that we learned a lot from. There's a lot of education to the customer because it's not a watch that you just put on the wrist and tells the time once it's set up. You have to download the app. You have to link it to your watch, you know. So it was a good exercise. It's put us a little bit in a different barrier and a different, you know, way. But we love that product, and it's doing very well for the brand. And I love the design. So it counts your step. Your sleep, you have the GMT on it, or the world timer, you've got, when someone calls you, you've got the watch that vibrates and the hand moves to the phone call or the notification. The idea is that you are not always connected. When I'm with my kids, if I wear the vintage 2.0, if my wife, my in-laws are calling, then it will come to my watch, but all the rest can just wait for me to be back online. And that's the way we use it. So it's not, distracted all the time. It's just when you choose to be distracted, because we've got enough distraction in the world, I think, at the moment.
I think it's an interesting take on that connected idea. Certainly my experience from having had smartwatches both in the Apple camp and the Android camp, really what they come down to is just another notification vehicle. We don't get the good health features here in Australia of the heart monitoring and all that for whatever reason. So if you have a watch that literally just gives you a buzz to say, okay, check your phone for the message, that seems a logical progression on still wearing something that looks nice, but doesn't necessarily take up your whole life, which I find those watches are quite intrusive. So it's a very interesting market, and wish you every success with it. They're very nice looking watches.
Thank you. Yeah, no, they're doing very well for the brand again, bringing a younger crowd to the brand. And then once, in 2-3 years time, they will want to move up and they will go into an automatic. And that's the natural progression usually. Or if they're a bit older and they want to keep track of their steps and their activity, that's also something that we find a lot. And they still have a watch that looks like a watch and not like a computer.
Talking about that progression of I guess price and quality or grade of watch going from, sort of something quartz to automatic, for example, as one progression. I think I read somewhere that it was one of your strategic decisions to make it an affordable brand, to keep it affordable. What was the idea there? Because they are very, very, for what you're getting and the quality of the componentry that goes in, they are a very affordable watch. So can you talk to me about that decision?
Well, look, we don't have Brad Pitt or Sharapova to pay, so that also helps. So we don't have the big fancy offices. I don't drive a Ferrari. So all of that helps. Our margins are not, you know, huge, but they're still enough for everybody to make a living. But yes, I'm an ex-CFO, so I know how much components should cost. So I'm very good at that, at keeping the cost for the quality at the best possible ratio. And then we don't take the piece on the price. We're just very, very reasonable in terms of pricing because we want all our customers to have the best experience and they have. And that's why we want to build a brand. Just the way I like living, you know, I think it's, you feel better at night when you go to bed and you know, you've done your 150%, and that you've got nothing to, if someone comes back with anything you're completely comfortable with it. And, but yeah, the Ocean Moon, every time we sell a watch at $1,200 Australian dollars for a watch like the Ocean Moon, I'm always a little bit cringing inside. I'm like, you know, if there was another brand on that watch, it would be, the 3,000, 3,500, or between 2,500 to 3,500 very easily. But that's what you get with Bozelle, a very good, well-priced watch for the price.
That brings me to another thought that the consumer is so much more educated today than they ever have been. And that's not just in watches, but everything. And I think that most watch enthusiasts understand that there are very, very few watches for any brand that you're buying that's truly all in-house, that's truly artisan-made hands, truly artisan-made movements. That said, there are some brands like Tudor and whatever that deliver in-house for very, very reasonable prices compared to their sister brands and so on. But the consumer is so educated that they understand that when they buy a Bozelle or they buy a Farah or they buy another of these independent brands, that the guts are the same as some of the very big, very expensive brands. So do you think that there comes a time in the industry where there'll be a reckoning? Is that why the big brands are perhaps losing some share to independents like yourself and the others that we've talked about?
I think so, but we will never be able to go to compete with their budgets. You know, it's at the end of the day, it has to, you know, they've got the big budget, big advertising budget. They've been here for many years and it will be hard. But where we can compete is on the product, just like you said. And for example, I'm not going to name them on this podcast, but two big brands, Swiss brands that sell between 5 to 15,000 are using exactly the same brand, the same supplier, the strap supplier. So we're using it's a new recycled plastic that comes from Switzerland. And what we did is that I had a customer who came in with one of these big brand on his wrist, and I could see that the strap was getting a bit wear and tear just after 2 months. And I was like, whoa. So I called the supplier. I said, that can't happen, you know, after 2 months. So we improved, we reinforced all the holes, and that brand had a simple simple pin buckle. And so I reinforced the strap, plus I put a deployed buckle for a watch that costs 7-8 times less than that big brand. So in terms of product, we are pushing the boundaries. We are pushing those brands to deliver better product because, like you said, people are now more savvy and they know, but we will never be able to compete. You know, if one brand has $100,000 per month to spend on Google advertising, I don't have $100,000 to spend on Google advertising. So that's it, you know.
Through Fine Watches, I try and spread the word, as we've been talking about here, that you don't really have to buy one of the obvious big brands, whether it's one of the big five, if you can afford it, or even one of the more affordable, very high quality brands that are out there. Bozelle's a perfect example. Can you talk about some other brands in that really good value, regardless of price, but good value sphere that you admire and whose work you like and that the listeners should perhaps have a look at, and maybe both new and vintage?
Oh, look, I think Baltic is doing an exceptional job. I'm extremely jealous of their success. They're doing something really, really good. And the other day, I'm following our master beaver that's on Instagram, and he was, having a Baltic on his wrist. And I wish one day he has a Bozell on his wrist. That made me very jealous. But yeah, no, I think they're doing a very good job, Baltic. Getting the best of what people want at the moment. A friend of mine in France has a brand called Marsh Lab. Again, it's a little bit of a vintage, but he's got a real brand. Green is his color, and he's mastering the brand, and it's very and he's a genuine he loves what he's doing. Yeah, look, there's so many. We all respect each other. We're all doing the best we can, and I find that it's great to see so many newcomers coming in. But yeah, my eye is more towards Europe and France and Switzerland. What's happening there? Ah, yeah, of course, Bayo, Thomas Bayo, what he's doing. I'm part of the watch distribution network. I'm one of the four or five with Thomas, and his new concept of distribution. So his brand is more. Of course, the design is important, but he's more thinking about how to distribute the watch, and he's opening eyes to the industry players on how to distribute a bit differently. So it's not all about the watch. Is that a list long enough?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I agree with you. I think Baltic is really, really nailing it, and he's created something very unique that's distinctly vintage looking, but you can't actually say, oh, it's a 50 Fathoms, or it's a Polaris, or it's something. He's created something quite unique, and I like them as well. A brand that's come up in discussion before, and I've never gone into it, and I think you probably have an appreciation for them, is the French brand Lip Montre. Is so amazing that some of their designs are so crazy, but they make some beautiful watches in the vintage market.
Oh, look, Leap is, vintage. Leap is, an old brand, true Besançon French brand from back in the day. We all know Leap, growing up in France. It's a beautiful brand. I think they are starting again, which is great. The design with Silverstein, with the red arrow, the blue, the yellow. It's just, you're right. It's iconic, and the design, with that watch that has the pusher on the side, the yellow pusher on the side. I mean, it's just, they pushed a lot of boundaries.
I love them, and I'd love to get one or two of those in the collection. They're very, very cool. One of the things that strikes me about Lip is that you speak to anyone French, they know it, they love it. There's this almost a sense of national pride about that brand. So talking about that, you obviously, even with the accent, you bring a great deal of Australian pride to your brand. Do you think there's an opportunity for the Australian watch manufacturing market to grow? Do you think there's an appetite for Australian design and Australian brands?
Surely there are. Look, since I started, there's been so many brands that followed, in Melbourne, in Canberra, in Queensland, everywhere. There's, at one point there was a new brand coming up every month in my feed, and they're all doing great stuff, all different, a little bit different price point, different way of doing things. We are unique with Bozell on the Swiss, with the Swiss heritage and the Swiss accent. What Nick Hacko is doing is absolutely exceptional, bringing true watch manufacturing by making his own movement here in Australia. absolutely exceptional. I love the respect. I know how much it cost and how much headache it would have been for him to be able to achieve that. So, and but yeah, I think we've got a lot to offer. Australia is an amazing country, and we need to bring back manufacturing. All the manufacturing left now lately, you know, first it was manufacturing with the clothes and textile. Now it's cars leaving the country, but we need to bring back, if we can do a little something and bring back a little bit of manufacturing here, with like Nikako is doing, like we are doing with the watch cases in Adelaide, it would be awesome, and people love Australia, so of course, you know, there's a market.
Excellent. Kennedy, I'd like to finish up all of the conversations with the same finishing point and ask my guests about their grail watches, both attainable and absolutely money's no object.
Look, I'll start with the other one because I already touched on it. It's the Vacheron Constantin, l'American from 1921. And then I don't know, but just the watch that does the, you know, a Seiko, beautiful watches, you know, a nice diver Seiko. You take it, you know, with the NH 35, even the NH 15 inside. It just puts it on your wrists and it goes and it always does the job and it always works well. And so, yeah, I would say that. And the Vacheron Constantin American.
Absolutely fantastic. Christophe, it's been wonderful talking to you. And yeah, thank you again for joining me.
Thank you, Ben, for having me. I really appreciated the talk, and thank you again.
Well, here we are at the end of episode 10 of the Fine Watches podcast. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Christophe Hoppe of Boisel. I must say a huge thank you to all of the amazing guests who've joined me so far. It's been inspirational, educational, and it's great to receive lovely feedback from listeners around the world, as far as Denmark, Bahrain, the UK, the US, and a whole stack of other places. If you'd like to get in touch, you can always reach me by a direct message at finewatchesau on Instagram or at hello@finewatches.com.au. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a review or give us a rating. It helps us reach more people and is very much appreciated. Until next time, from the Fine Watches podcast, I'm Ben. Enjoy.